It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Our days begin with our fingers doing a tap tap here and there and a flick on a switch. How many buttons, keys, and switches do you think our fingertips touch? Call in with a question, share comments about switches that may be, you know, second nature to us. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jason Pushkar is a professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee. New book, it's called The Switch, an off and on history of digital humans. Jason, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so your research included counting how many times a day you pushed a button or flipped a switch, hit a key. What did you learn?
Well, I learned it was a lot more than I expected. That was way at the beginning of this when I wondered, could this possibly be a book or not? And I thought, well, I'd better count and just see how many switches I push. And I think the first sign of trouble was I couldn't figure out how to do it without recording keystroke logging spyware on my computer and having a button-based clicker counter, you know, the kind that ticket takers have at the door. And in the course of a full day of work and email and everything from the kitchen appliances to the dashboard of the car, it came out to almost 30,000 different switches and buttons. And so it was at that point that I thought, if you do anything 30,000 times a day, you better really think hard about what it is that you're doing. You better think about what it's doing back to you.
Yes, indeed. And so talk a little bit about, I guess, the history of the word switch and what you learned about what we do when we flip on a light.
Sure. When the first things that kind of look like electrical switches crop up in the early 1800s, they're almost exclusively connected to telegraph machinery. And so the input key of a Morse Veil telegraph is pretty close to the first electrical switch, though not the first switch. But for many decades, the word switch doesn't exist yet. And so when you read patents from the mid-19th century, early electrical machinery, they refers to the thing to turn it off and on as, say, an automatic circuit opening and closing device. So they needed something a little bit more congenial than that. The word switch really got borrowed from railroad switch tracks, because a railroad switch track was something that has only two functional positions. You can go straight or you can turn off. And so it seemed to be a kind of analogy for the way a switch works, with one of two options, on or off. But even the railroad switch track was developed by analogy from a switch, you know, a kind of curved piece of a stick or something that you might use for beating something. And that's named, it's named after the curved rail that seems to lash against the fixed rail, sliding back and forth. So by degrees, we developed this terminology of switching. And, by the 20th century, people started to talk about switching careers or switching trains. And to use that as a synonym for human change, we kind of forget that we're using a machine analogy or a machine metaphor when we say we're going to switch careers or switch trains. But actually we are, and we can watch that develop pretty quickly through the 1800s.
And it's also about choice. You have this line, switches transform change into choice. Can you explain like the human agency here and switches?
Yeah, you know, I really think about it in terms of choices being belonging to individuals. And I think one of the things that switches do really powerfully is help us feel our individuality, our autonomy, our responsibility, our separateness, our independence. But to be an individual, to be freestanding in that way, your actions actually have to be individuated too. And, you know, out in the real world in everyday life, I think it's true that almost all of the time, actions kind of blend into each other. It's really hard to find hard starting and stopping points in nature for action. Something happened, it influenced this next thing, that influenced something else. It all gets kind of mixed up together. And if you want to sort those out, say at a trial, you're going to need a lot of lawyers and a lot of money to do it. But maybe an easier way is to invent some little machines that create really evident starting and stopping points in the flow of action, so that actions don't seem to get mixed up with each other. So when I push a switch to turn on a light, there can't really be a huge debate that I did or did not turn on the light. There's only one way to turn it on. It didn't turn on by itself. And you can't really see any other part of the process that's involved, right? Mm-hmm. I turned on the light. Mm-hmm. I sometimes think about heating my home that way. I walk up to the thermostat and I touch a little button. Up goes the temperature by a degree. But 200 years ago, I would have had to be stacking wood, chopping wood. Somebody would have cut the tree down, brought it to the house. Someone had to dry it. Someone else probably brought it in. Heating the house would have been this big team effort. And all that labor was visible. You could just see it. But now when I heat the home, I push a button and I don't see any of it. There's still a fire and there's still resources that are burning somewhere down at the power plant. But the switch has helped me forget about that so I can more easily experience the results as belonging just to me.
You also examine how children are enthralled by elevator buttons. As buttons have become more high tech and digital, so easy just to touch and be gone, how are kids interacting with buttons differently?
Well, I think that might have been the real source of this project. Kids are older now, but when they were young, I think I noticed just how enthralled they were by buttons, and the elevator button was a big one. They would have murdered each other to be the first one to push the elevator button. And I think I do remember thinking, what is the big deal? The switches are kind of boring. They do the same thing every time. They don't move very much. There's just not a lot going on. So what's the thrill? And I think a lot of this book actually does try to think about switching from the child's perspective and to try to figure out what have we retained as adults from that. And I kind of came to the conclusion that if you think about pushing an elevator button from the perspective of a child can do so little powerfully or well. They can't write, they can't drive, they can't do any of the things they envy their parents doing. And the one thing they're really good at, destroying things, we don't let them do. So, what a predicament. And then here's this little button on the wall. They can walk up to it, and with no effort, they touch it, and a magic room appears. The whole family gets in, it vibrates a little, and you're in a different place. And for a child, it must be like getting on the Star Trek transporter. And they did that in the same way that me pushing the thermostat feels like I did all that because I can forget about everything else that assisted in the process. And I think that kind of the magic of switching, the apparent magic of switching, is so alive and evident in children. And that helped me a lot in this book to figure out how it maybe persists even for adults.
That little tiny index finger pushing that elevator button, giving them that little bit of power and authority in the moment. Jason Pushkar, professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee, new book called The Switch. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Jason, you write about the prevalence of the QWERTY keyboard and go deep into that history and the kinship to the musical instrument. How are musical and typing keyboards similar?
Well, this is a great year to talk about this because this happens to be the 150th anniversary of the QWERTY keyboard. And it is undoubtedly Wisconsin's most famous invention and most famous export to the whole world, much bigger than beer, if that's possible.
Wow.
The whole world types on QWERTY keyboards, and they were invented here in Milwaukee around 1873, and they were on sale by 1874. So this month, actually, November of 1873 was when they went into production and started rolling off assembly lines. And so, the keyboard developed kind of gradually out of musical instruments and interfaces that looked a lot like piano keyboards. So, through the mid 19th century, plenty of people were trying to invent personal writing machines. They didn't call anything a typewriter just yet, and the vast majority of those actually had little tiny keyboards that looked like toy pianos. And one of the reasons they had that was that they were all imitating another machine that wasn't a prototype and wasn't experimental. And that was what's called the printing telegraph. And those were kinds of telegraphs that were actually very popular. We never see them in movies about the 19th century, but they were all over and especially popular in Europe, though they were American inventions. And these were basically teletypes. You typed at one end, and the other end, without any Morse code, your message came out on a little paper tape. So they were really amazing, amazing inventions for the time. And the first ones were invented in the 1840s, just a couple years after the Morse Veil telegraph system that we're all more familiar with. And they had the white and black keys alternating. They weren't arranged in octaves, but they had the letters A through about the middle of the alphabet went from left to right on the black keys. And then from right to left, the second half of the alphabet wrapped around the other way and came back from right to left on the white keys. And if you look at your QWERTY keyboard today, even though we've changed the form of it, there's a lot that survives from that arrangement. So if you go left to right on black and right to left on white, A and Z are on top of each other, and they still are today.
That's what I just find so remarkable in your writing is that the keyboard that we're typing on today has remained remarkably the same over 150 years. How can that be?
I have no idea. I think it'd be like if we were riding around on bicycles with 4 foot wide big front wheels. And yet we don't do that. We found better bicycles. We don't crank our phones and talk into a horn sticking out of the wall. We don't, we've changed all those Victorian technologies, good as they were. We found different ways to do it. And yet the QWERTY keyboard is this bug in amber preserved from the past. And I think that's really remarkable. I guess if I have to try to explain it, I would say that, I think we make a mistake if we try to think about this in utilitarian terms, as if it is or it isn't the most efficient tool for the job and that has something to do with its survival. I think probably the reason we stick with it is that we like it on aesthetic grounds, that it's beautiful, it's familiar, it's comfortable, and maybe it's more like fashion in that way. Why do men wear neckties? There's no utilitarian explanation for why I wear a necktie, and my father wore a necktie, and his father wore a necktie, and his father wore a necktie. Somehow we started wearing neckties, and we passed it down from generation to generation, and it seems natural and right to do. And I think that that's kind of what the QWERTY keyboard is. Ironically enough, the fact that it's just a kind of piece of fashion means that it should be the most easy to change, but in fact, like neckties, it actually makes it the most resistant to change.
The book is called The Swish, Switch, Jason Pushkar, UW Milwaukee English professor, tracing the history of buttons and keys, how they interact with our lives. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Switches, keys, and buttons, they are part of everyday life and have proliferated massively and continuously in almost every area of life. That's according to UW Milwaukee English professor Jason Pushkar, whose new book, it's called The Switch. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy in Ripon is here. Hi, Randy. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Well, you guys kind of covered the typewriter keyboard layout, which today I still don't understand why we just don't do it logically, but you kind of answered that. But I'm 67 years old, and I remember the old dial phones. And now that I have cell phones and all that, the other thing I find frustrating is my construction big clumsy fingers. I'm always hitting adjacent keys on the keyboard, and I wish they would make things a little bit bigger, spaced out or something with these keyboards. Anyways, that's my comment.
Randy, thank you so much for that contribution. Jason, go ahead.
I'm with you, Randy. I think that a lot of the switches we use, they kind of masquerade as conveniences, but honestly, they interject all these incredible inconveniences. Maybe we get back the thrill of the power that I described with kids at the elevator, but they introduce all kinds of frustrations as well. And there are interfaces. You mentioned the dial telephone that, also worked really well. I also am old enough to remember the dial telephones, and I remember an early stage when they switched over from dial rotary telephones to buttons, but the buttons didn't beep yet. They made a kind of click, 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 click noise to, to imitate the dial. And it was just murder to use those things. And yet somehow we thought it must be worth it. I have a chapter in this book too about calculating machines and how hard people had to work in the late 19th century to make primitive mechanical calculating machines work with keys. They actually had really good ones that worked with dials and slides already. Why did they have to have buttons and keys? It made it so much harder to do. And eventually they got there, but it took decades and decades of hard work to do it. And it was never really clear why. So yeah, Randy, I sympathize completely with the inutility of so many buttons in our world today.
And you point out that the keyboards of basically the same size and shape and arrangement, that they're used around the world. What is like the global keyboard culture? I mean, are there people around the world who feel the same way Randy does?
I would imagine that they do. I mean, you know, and I keyboard culture, I'm thinking about the QWERTY arrangement, for instance, and the way in which we've all kind of taken for granted that that's how you write these days. And that's true even in Asian languages with very different ways of writing. Asian languages tend to use QWERTY keyboards with Roman letters on them. You type a few things in, and then a kind of algorithmic search function starts trying to find the right Asian language character, and you select it as it presents you with a menu of autofill options. And so there's really no escaping it. You know, even in languages that don't use the arrangement of Roman letters, like Greek or Russian, we still actually have the same basic shape with the staggered rows of keys, a row of numbers, three rows of letters, a space bar at the bottom. The consistency and the stability of that arrangement across so many societies and so many different languages is just really stunning to me.
You say that buttons have the potential to distance people from one another. How do buttons affect people's sense of individuality?
Well, I think they confirm it and augment it. I mean, I think of the world that we've made and that we've covered with switches is functioning a little bit like a mirror that reflects back an image of ourselves at twice its normal size. We feel so much more powerful and capable than we would otherwise. I think of them sometimes kind of like assistive technologies or prosthetics. I'm wearing glasses right now. I have titanium screws in my right knee. I have a mouthful of dental fillings. And without these cyborg add-ons, you know, I couldn't move around very well. I wouldn't be able to read. I wouldn't be able to eat normal food. They help me mechanically feel like a natural, able-bodied person. But I'm very machine dependent for that. And I think that switches kind of do something else, not with fillings in my mouth or screws holding together my knee, but really all around me. What they hold together is my conception of myself as somebody who's autonomous, capable, free, who can will an action and bring it about almost effortlessly. And that's hard to do in the rest of the world.
Jason Pushkar with us, professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee. New book is called The Switch. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jason, I want to bring up voting machines. You describe how voting machines mechanize democratic procedures. How does the use of buttons affect politics?
Well, the history of voting machines is obviously something a lot of people are interested in now because there's such an issue of trust with them. And that goes back to the very beginning. The first voting machines in the U.S. were used in Rochester, New York in around 1893. And then they were used in 1896 in a presidential election with disastrous results. And this first voting machine didn't look much like ours. It was a 7-foot square iron room closed on all sides with a double door. You went into this safe. One wall is covered with buttons, each one with a candidate name. You push these big buttons in. And the idea was that it would tabulate the choice of the voter and mechanically record all this. And you just sum it up at the end. The problem is it didn't work very well. Counts were off and so on. But, you know, the goal here was really to safeguard the privacy and the secrecy of the ballot so that people couldn't be coerced or bribed into voting anything other than their conscience. But I kind of love the model of this first voting machine, which shows you the cost of that, which is Not only do you have the individualizing effect of the button, but you have the isolating effect of this iron room that you get locked inside in order to be a democratic subject, a democratic agent. And that's really different. An early English election in the 1800s would have been a raucous public affair, lots of singing, dancing on the green. But it was public, and your vote was public as well. So the cost of that individualized privacy that accomplished by both the button and the enclosure in the voting booth was a kind of isolation as well.
In our final moments together, where will the next stages of switching lead? What do you envision?
I don't envision that it's going to go anywhere anytime soon. People are always predicting that we'll have something better, voice control or thought control. But I think people actually really like to control their world with their fingers. And I think we have a whole culture that really is finger-based, and that voice control or even some kind of thought control, which people are experimenting with. I think that those are in some ways less satisfying than using our fingers. We learned to do that over many decades. They're still comparatively recently. I saw a story the other day in the New York Times about a new personal assistant called the AI pin. It's a little lapel pin. It clips on your shirt,
Right next to the necktie.
right next to the necktie, exactly. And when you it can talk to you, but it can also project a little interface onto your hand, and you can control it by just touching your fingers. So your own fingers become the switches or the buttons. You touch one finger to this finger, and something happens this to this one, another one happens. So the body itself can be turned into a switch too.
To be continued. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jason Pushkar, professor of literature, UW-Milwaukee. New book is called The Switch, an off and on history of digital humans. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.